From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the evolution of the modern stock market. We talk with Mark Smith, a former stock trader and vice president of Goldman Sachs. He's written a new history of Wall Street. Also today, actress Charlotte Rampling. Following a long depression, she's making a comeback with her new movie, Under the Sand. She'll tell us why she's gravitated to dark roles, such as her part in the 1974 film The Night Porter, as a concentration camp survivor who enters into a sadomasochistic relationship with a Nazi who abused her in the camp. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After 20 years as a stock trader and serving as vice president of Goldman Sachs, Mark Smith left Wall Street to write. His first book is all about the street. It's a history of the American stock market from 1901 to the present, called Toward Rational Exuberance. It isn't an investment guide. Smith says his purpose is to help readers understand the modern stock market and the central role it plays in today's economy. The year his book begins, 1901, is the year, he says, marks the beginning of the modern stock market. U.S. Steel was formed that year, a trust that challenged investors' assumptions of how stocks should be valued.
Well, up to that point, and frankly, after that point to a large extent, but up to that point, stocks were evaluated strictly on the basis of the dividends they paid. Nobody really wanted to try to predict the future as we do routinely today, in part because accurate information wasn't available, in part because there was so much blatant manipulation and chicanery going on that nobody could trust the information that was made available. But U.S. Steel, when Morgan assembled that company, what he was trying to do was to say that, look, this company will be more efficient going forward. It will earn more in the future because of the way it's constituted. We can't just look at it as the sum total of the companies that were merged together to form U.S. Steel. We have to realize that as an ongoing entity, it will generate more earnings and it will be a different animal than what has gone before. And so that was the first inkling, I think, of the notion that stocks should be viewed for their future potential earnings, which is routine today. But people don't realize back at that time, if you tried to say, I'm going to anticipate what a stock is going to earn 2 or 3 years from now, you'd be accused of just engaging in speculation, that it was considered to be something that couldn't be done. All you looked at really was the dividend the company paid then and nothing else.
You said there was a lot of chicanery in this era in the stock market. Give us an example of what was going on.
Well, I have a number of stories in my book, but one of my favorite stories is a man by the name of John Gates, who ran a major steel company that was actually merged into U.S. Steel by J.P. Morgan. And what Gates did, this company was doing very well. The stock was selling at a high price. Then all of a sudden, out of the blue, he announced that he was closing 13 of his steel plants, presumably because business wasn't that very good. It wasn't that good. Now, obviously, that caught the market by surprise. The stock dropped sharply. But what had happened is that Gates had sold short the stock of that company, which is really, you know, the selling short is the reverse of buying. In a way, you're betting the stock is going to go down. He had sold short for his personal account, closed the plants, caused the stock to go down, then bought back his short to make a profit, then reopened the plants and went on doing business as he always had before. Now, this was a blatant manipulation. It would be, you know, completely illegal today, but that kind of thing happened all the time. It was considered to be routine back at the turn of the century. And for obvious reasons, the poor investor who was caught by that kind of manipulation, you know, couldn't be very trusting toward the way companies were managed or the kind of information that was available to him. Hence, you had to value stocks based on very conservative criteria.
And were there no laws governing the stock market then?
Very few. I mean, there were laws regarding fraud and a few things like that, but most of the regulations that existed were New York Stock Exchange regulations that grew up over time primarily to protect the members of the New York Stock Exchange, not the public.
How was business transacted on the stock market at the turn of the century? If you wanted to buy or sell a stock, what would you do?
Well, actually, you know, the New York Stock Exchange and the way it operates hasn't changed that much over the last 100 years. Now, NASDAQ being a separate market system is completely different. But the system of actually buying and selling stocks on the New York Stock Exchange is almost unchanged over the last century. Basically, there is a single post or a point where a given stock is traded. All the buy and sell orders come together at that particular post and are matched up. And that balance of supply and demand then causes the stock to either go up or go down. And, you know, obviously there have been some changes in technology since then, but that fundamental open outcry auction system, which is the way it's defined, hasn't changed much in the last 100 years.
My guest is B. Mark Smith. He's a former stock market trader and author of the new book, Toward Rational Exuberance, The Evolution of the Modern Stock Market. Let's talk about the Dow Jones Average. This was created at the turn of the century, where your book begins. It was created by who?
Charles Dow. And he actually was the owner and original editor of the Wall Street Journal and came up with the idea of creating an average. At first, it was of basically rail stocks, and he added a few industrial stocks, you know, which created what we know now as the Dow Jones Industrial Average in 1896. And at that time, there were only 12 what he called industrial stocks that he felt were worthy of including in the average. Now the average is up to 30 today. But that was the only average that goes back that far in history. All the other market indices that we use today didn't get started until sometime later in the century. So for points of comparison in my book, I use the Dow as much as possible because it's the only one that's continuous over the course of the 100 years.
What was his intention when he put together the average?
To try to come up with some way of measuring the market, because up to that point, obviously, there were no calculators or computers, and everything was very primitive, and people really didn't have any way of knowing what the market was doing. You could observe individual stocks, but until somebody came up with an index to measure all the stocks, or at least representative stocks, there was no way to really give you a broad gauge of what the overall market was doing.
How do you think the Dow Jones average changed how people looked at the market?
Well, it made it possible to talk about the market. In other words, prior to that point, you could only talk about individual stocks. Now, or when the Dow was developed and subsequent averages, you could then say, well, the market did this or the market did that, as opposed to, say, U.S. Steel did this, and then just take U.S. Steel as a proxy for the market. So it gave a much more accurate means of assessing what was happening in the overall stock market.
Let's jump ahead a few years to Clarence Barron, who founded the financial weekly Barron's in 1921. You say one of his contributions is that he thought outside investors could invest successfully in stocks and not be adversely impacted by the machinations of market operators, as long as investors made solid long-term investment decisions based on sound economic fundamentals and stayed away from short-term speculation. Was that a new idea?
In a sense, in the early 1920s, Barron and a couple of other people begin to talk more about, you know, what I referred to earlier with U.S. Steel, in that, you know, people should look forward and anticipate what the market was going to do as opposed to just judging it based on the dividends that stocks currently paid. You started to see slowly in the first few decades of the 20th century this idea become developed. Barron was one of the first people who actually, you know, stated it in his new publication, Barron's. It seems like common sense now. So much of what has developed over the last 100 years we just take as being intuitively obvious now. But at that time, you know, Barron's was trying to refute what was a widely perceived impression that because the market was subject to so much manipulation, investors just couldn't possibly succeed in it. They just were playing a losing game. And his notion was that in the long run, stocks were going to grow with the economy and with the growth in corporate profits, and the manipulation wasn't going to have any effect. So if you just tried to focus on the long run, you wouldn't be adversely impacted by the manipulators.
Of course, Barron had this idea and made this statement just a few years before the stock market crashed. So the long term wasn't really looking all that good.
Well, see, that's one of the things I try to deal with in the book is mythologies grow up over time about the market based on conventional wisdom that develops after the fact. And quite often that conventional wisdom turns out to be wrong. I mean, for example, you know, I spend quite a bit of time talking about the 1929 crash. And a lot of people would be surprised to know that that crash really wasn't much more severe than a number of other crashes that had occurred in the 19th century or some declines that have occurred since. For example, in 1987, in that crash, In one day, the market was down 23%, which was twice the decline of the largest single daily decline in 1929. And so the notion that somehow the 1929 crash was this disastrous event that had never happened before and somehow unique in financial history really isn't accurate. The only reason that people pay so much attention to it today is that it was followed by the Great Depression. It was the Great Depression that destroyed the stock market, not the 1929 crash.
So you don't think the crash helped cause the depression?
No. As a matter of fact, I argue quite strenuously that the crash did not cause the depression. It did not really even predict the depression because at the time, the state of economic knowledge was nowhere near sufficient to make that projection. And what people forget, again, that this gets lost in the mythology, is once the crash itself ended in mid-November 1929, the market rallied substantially and within about 3 or 4 months had gained back over half of what it had lost in the crash. So in March or April of 1930, somebody sitting there at that point in time could easily have said, well, the crash is gone. It's just another one of these declines or market breaks that we saw repeatedly in the 19th century. It really isn't that significant. Then, of course, the Great Depression came. That's what, you know, pulled the stock market down, but that was an entirely different animal.
So what's your theory about what caused the depression?
Well, I don't claim to be an economist, and economists still today argue about that. But basically, as I say very briefly in the book, that it, probably poor Federal Reserve monetary policy combined with a weak banking system that basically just collapsed under pressure, combined with some very bad protectionist trade legislation that stifled international trade, all these things together caused what would have been a normal cyclical downturn in the economy to turn into a depression. But again, the 1929 stock crash had virtually nothing to do with that, and it certainly could not have predicted the depression that happened later.
You write about a lot of evolutionary changes in the stock market over the past century, and I'm wondering if really immersing yourself in stock market history changed your idea in any fundamental way about how sound the stock market is and about how safe it is for the long term.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I've been interested in the stock market since I was 15 years old. And I would actually, when I was in high school and college, go back into the library and read through old newspaper accounts of the famous crashes in the 19th century, or 1929 as an example. So when the 1987 crash occurred, and at that time I was a professional trader working at First Boston, and I was right in the middle of it, at one point when I realized that the market was down over 20% on the day, and I realized that the largest single daily decline in 1929 had been only slightly over 12%, I said, wow. This is an important event. And I guess you could say that my knowledge of history and the fact I'd spent so much time for my personal interest in studying stock market history caused me to look at an event in my professional life differently than I might otherwise have done.
Well, tell me more about what that day was like for you. Did you lose a lot of money personally? Did your clients lose a lot of money? What was on the line for you?
Well, basically, as a professional trader, I was trading for the firm's account. At that time, it was First Boston. You know, later, I moved to Goldman Sachs. So I was trading the firm's money. It wasn't really clients' money. And the kind of products that I was trading at that time, which were stocks and then convertible bonds relative to stocks, actually didn't do that badly, because in a sense we were playing relationships between different kinds of securities as opposed to just being, you know, owning stocks and watching them go down. But it was fascinating, because as I watched the numbers go down and realized what was happening, you almost had a sense of unreality. You know, people who've been involved in automobile accidents, for example, tell me that you seem like you're almost divorced from reality. You're floating up in the air someplace, sort of looking down at all the chaos around you. And that was sort of like the impression that I had when I was sitting here right in the middle of all this chaos and all these billions and hundreds of billions of dollars being lost. It was almost like, wow, could this really be happening? I know that sounds a little strange, but that's the way I reacted to it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is B. Mark Smith. He's the author of the new book, Toward Rational Exuberance, The Evolution of the Modern Stock Market. He's a former trader and was a vice president at Goldman Sachs. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is B. Mark Smith. He's the author of the new book, Toward Rational Exuberance, The Evolution of the Modern Stock Market. Now, some reviewers have really taken you to task for coming up with this title, Toward Rational Exuberance, which is an answer to the whole irrational exuberance thing, which is both the title of a best-selling book and something that Alan Greenspan said to describe how he thought the market was behaving a couple of years ago, you know, irrationally exuberant. But now that you have your book, Toward Rational Exuberant, you know, the market has really been, you know, doing comparatively poorly. So, you know, a lot of book reviewers are saying, boy, the timing's really bad for this title.
Yeah, unfortunately, we couldn't control the timing. But it's interesting that I think that would fall into another case of what I call mythology about the stock market. For example, obviously, technology stocks have not done well in the last year or so. Or if somebody, you know, had all his portfolio invested in .com or internet stocks, then obviously they've been decimated. But if you look at the Dow Jones average, it's right around 11,000, which is only a few points away from its all-time high. If you look at the Standard & Poor's 500, which that index represents 90% of the market capitalization in this country, including a lot of technology stocks, it was down at one point a little over 20% last year, which barely meets the definition for a mild bear market. It's since come back. That is not at all a very serious decline by historical standards. I mean, when people talk about a bursting bubble or these huge losses that have supposedly been inflicted upon investors, they're really only talking about a certain narrow group of stocks, meaning the technology stocks, primarily the NASDAQ technology stocks, a few of the internet, .com, telecommunication stocks. The broader stock market as a whole has not done that badly at all. And that's what I try to do in my book. I don't gear my book towards a particular point in time. I'm not trying to say in my book that stock prices are too high or too low. What I'm trying to do is explain the process that's occurred over the last 100 years and put a lot of these myths in perspective. In my mind, a lot of the mythology about what supposedly happened in the market in the last year or so isn't accurate because people are just looking at one particular segment of the market and using that as a means of generalizing to the market as a whole, which is not correct.
On the other hand, there seems to be a general economic downturn going on, and a lot of businesses are reporting losses. And those reported losses are affecting other businesses' stocks because there's this general fear of a downward trend.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's happened before. I mean, we've had recessions before, and I'm sure we'll have it again.
A lot of people have money tied up in the market through their retirement funds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are your thoughts about how the market's going to be affected when the baby boom starts to retire and a lot of people start withdrawing their money from those retirement funds in the market?
Well, I think you'll actually see an effect before that. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that in the 1980s and 90s, as people have moved towards investing much more of their pension assets in the market, people have developed a longer-term time horizon. Obviously, if you're investing for retirement, you're not usually investing for money you're going to need in the next 4 or 5 years, so you can afford to ride out the risk. After the 1987 crash, for example, when a lot of people were worried that the average investor would panic and pull his money out of the market, that didn't happen. It's because people have bought into this notion that stocks are a good long-term investment and you don't worry about the short-term fluctuations. Hence, you're willing to take more risk. You're willing to invest a larger percentage of your assets in stocks. But as the baby boom generation, of which I consider myself a member, moves closer to retirement, we will become more risk averse. Even before we start taking the money actually out, like you suggest, we will start thinking, hey, I can't afford to take a 20 or 30 year time horizon anymore. I've got to be much more concerned about these short term fluctuations. Hence, maybe I should reduce the percentage of my portfolio that's invested in stocks. As we become more risk averse, I think that will dampen the rate of increase in the stock market going forward, even before the baby boomers actually start to withdraw their money. So that's a very major effect that I see coming in the next 5, 10, 15 years.
So tell me more about what you think that'll mean.
Well, I think what it means is you're not going to see the kind of rates of increase that we saw in the 1990s in the stock market. Part of the reason that the stock prices went up so fast in the 90s, obviously, is that the economy was doing very well. But beyond that, stocks rose even faster than the rate of growth in the economy or the rate of growth in corporate earnings because people were moving towards this willingness to take more risk. They're willing to put more of their portfolio in stocks because they had this long-term philosophy. They're willing to buy more speculative stocks because they had a longer-term time horizon. As the baby boom generation moves closer to retirement, even before they actually start taking the money out, I think you'll see a reversal of that process, which means if people take less risk, if they want to own fewer stocks in their portfolio, the stock market won't go up as fast as it has in the past. In fact, I think it'll probably only go up roughly as fast as corporate earnings do in the future, which historically is about 7% or so.
President Bush supports the proposal of investing Social Security money in the stock market. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, actually, both Bush and Gore proposed ways of using federal tax dollars to subsidize investment in the stock market. The primary difference between Gore's proposal and Bush's proposal was that Gore proposed to do it outside of the Social Security system and use general tax revenues, and his proposal was also slightly more tilted towards lower-income individuals. But both of them, in essence, accepted the notion that the federal government should, in some way or another, subsidize through the use of tax dollars, whether they're Social Security tax dollars or general revenue tax dollars, the idea of investing in the market. And I think it makes sense in a limited way because the returns that this typical Social Security investor gets now or the Social Security participant gets now are so poor historically that even if you make the more conservative assumptions that I'm making about what the market is going to do in the future, it's hard to see a scenario where you're going to get less than 2%, which is basically what the Social Security participants have been getting up to this point. So in a limited sense, I think both the Bush and the Gore proposals make sense. And there's really not that much of a difference between the two other than that Gore tries to preserve the fiction, really, that he's doing it outside the Social Security system to preserve the so-called lockbox, whereas Bush does it within the Social Security system. But they both basically have endorsed the same idea. And I agree with it in a limited way.
Now that you're not a trader anymore, and now that you say most of your money is tied up in mutual funds, do you follow daily information very carefully?
I'll watch CNBC. I read the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, New York Times every day. And so I do, in part because I'm just naturally interested in it, in part because it might ultimately influence some investment decisions I make, and in part because I'm researching another book on the global stock market, so I need to be aware of these things. So all three of those factors come into play, but I do follow pretty closely, yes.
When you watch one of the financial shows and all the experts there offering their stock tips, what do you think?
Well, some of my comments I probably couldn't make over the public airwaves, but I've always joked that a lot of these guys who are market prognosticators get up in the morning and they have three separate explanations for what's going to happen in the market that day. They have one that they'll use if the market goes up, they have another one they use if the market goes down, and they have another one they'll use if the market stays unchanged. And they wait till the end of the day, and then they pick the one that applies and they use that. So I don't have a lot of faith in the ability of people to make short-term market judgments, I think, and I've presented a lot of the evidence in my book. There's a surprising amount of data that shows that it's really very difficult to do that. And certainly my own 20 years of experience as a professional trader, where I, if anybody, should have been able to consistently outsmart the market on a short-term basis, and I never was able to, and I always thought I was a pretty good trader, and my employers did most of the time. So I take a lot of what is said on CNBC and some of these financial programs with a grain of salt. I guess that's the best way I can put it. Diplomatically.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
B. Mark Smith is the author of the new book Toward Rational Exuberance, The Evolution of the Modern Stock Market. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, making a comeback after a long depression. We talk with Charlotte Rampling, star of such films as The Damned, The Night Porter, Stardust Memories, and The Verdict. In her new film, Under the Sand, she plays a woman whose husband has disappeared. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Charlotte Rampling is making a comeback after a long bout of depression that prevented her from acting for several years. She started her career in England in the mid-60s. Her best-known films include Georgie Girl, The Damned, The Night Porter, Zardoz, Farewell My Lovely, Stardust Memories, and The Verdict. For the past 25 years, she's lived in France. She plays an English woman living in France in the new French film Under the Sand. When the film begins, Rampling's character, Marie, is driving with her husband, Jean, to their summer home. There are long silences on the trip, and after their arrival, Jean seems detached. Soon they go to the beach. Marie takes a nap while Jean prepares for an ocean swim. She wakes up to find he's disappeared. Viewers are unsure if Jean has drowned, committed suicide, or walked out on his wife. Marie is unable to accept any of these possibilities and carries on as if he's expected back momentarily. In this scene, she meets her friend Amanda at a restaurant. It's months after Marie's husband has disappeared, but she's still talking about him in the present tense.
So how are things?
Okay. I'm just a bit tired.
Why don't you come to spend this weekend with us in the country and rest up?
What about Jean? I'm worried about him.
What do you mean?
I'm just wondering if...
If what?
I'm just wondering if he's not thinking about suicide.
You mean, you think that Jean might actually have committed suicide last summer?
Amanda, if you knew anything about him, you would tell me, wouldn't you?
Of course I would. You're my best friend, Marie. But now it's time to forget. There's no point going over it again and again. You have to carry on, Marie. You have to live for yourself.
Charlotte Rampling, welcome to Fresh Air. The part in Under the Sand was written for you by the director and screenwriter François Ozon. Did he tell you why he wrote this for you, why he sought you out?
I think he wanted a woman, an actress, but also a woman who was prepared to delve very deeply into all different areas that are not necessarily very comfortable, without being inhibited and without wondering what she necessarily looked like, without wondering about the fact that she was acting or not. He wanted it to be more of an experience, the whole film. And I think the way that I work has quite often been like this, and I think that's what he picked up on and was very intrigued by and wanted to sort of take it a step further, really.
Now, my understanding is that you shot the first part of the movie, and then François Ozon, with your input, wrote the rest of the movie. So the first part of the movie takes you up to the point where the husband disappears. Did your interpretation of the first part of the movie change as you participated in the writing process of the second part of the movie? Did you get different ideas about what this couple's marriage was like, what kind of person your character was?
Well, I think in a way, by living quite a while, because between those two periods ended up being, well, a bit longer because we had money problems, it ended up being about 5 months. So during those 5 months, I didn't work on another project. It was very much about really trying to understand and be in that situation, but not necessarily in a conscious way, but just somehow, you know, like living in your dreams with the idea of this kind of loss, which I'd actually personally been through way back with my sister when I was 20 and probably had never really come to terms with, because you don't really very easily come to terms with grief. Nobody knows really how to grieve. Some do it better than others. But in our five-month period of that writing period, we had an awful lot of time to find out about Marie and about who, you know, who she meets and who can help her and how she actually comes through.
What happened to your sister?
My sister died when she was 23 and I was 20, quite suddenly, I mean very suddenly, a brain hemorrhage. And so the shock sort of ricocheted throughout our family, and my mother didn't really recover. She just died recently, but she sort of, some huge part of her died when my sister died, and she never really recovered. So she was unable to come to terms with it, and she was a broken woman. And I, you know, as a younger girl, just sort of got on and lived my life, but realized when I was doing this film, all sorts of things came through to make me, I don't know, understand, or just to put things to rest, let's say.
Did you draw on your mother's reaction, too? Because you witnessed, you not only experienced your sister's death from, you know, from your point of view, but you saw your mother be totally broken by it.
Yes, I suppose so. You see, I suppose I was able to do this film in the way that I did it. And it seems that it's come across quite powerfully. And I think probably the only way I wrote was able to do it because I've lived through all that for so many years. And it's sort of haunted me, you know, for many, many years. Because you don't really know what to do about it, and you put it away, and I banished it and pretended. You pretend, and you go into denial like Marie does, and you say, well, I mean, it's happened, but I'm not going to think about it, you know. I'm not actually going to think of what it means, and I'm not going to go into that darkness. But actually, you end up having to. And you end up having to in rather odd ways. So I didn't... The actual grieving process that Marie goes through is condensed in a quite a short period of time, which is really quite healthy, because it can go on for can drag out for a very, very long time when people cannot come to terms with the death of somebody. And if it does go on for a very, very long time, it becomes very... very debilitating for the person, because you're sort of like held in some kind of grip. You know, it's like until you actually go towards the dead, you can't actually let yourself live. It's a very, well, we all know it's a complex
thing. It sounds like you're describing the last scene of the movie.
Almost, probably, yes. Yeah. The last scene in the movie is very much that. And it's swinging to and fro.
Charlotte Rampling is my guest, and she's starring in the new film Under the Sand. You were born in England in 1946. Your father was a British colonel who became a NATO commander. What did he do in World War II?
He was a gunner in the Royal Artillery, and he was posted to Malta.
So you grew up just after the war in England. Did you have vivid memories about the war through what your parents told you?
No, because my father never spoke of it. And it was very true about a lot of people who had been through the war. People didn't speak about things like that in those days. So I never knew. I never knew anything about anything that my father had done because he wouldn't tell me. And I still don't.
You must feel like there's a whole part of him that you don't know.
There is. And you never know, because it might just all come out and just before he dies. When I say all come out, that's, you know, in a way that's rather a romantic illusion. But he is beginning to talk now. Since my mother died, he's beginning to talk, which is really quite extraordinary. So you never know. You never know until somebody dies what they will reveal.
I don't know if your father talked to you about this, but he won a gold medal in the 400-meter relay in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. This is the Olympics that was documented in the Leni Riefenstahl movie Triumph of the Will. Could you see him in the film?
Yes, oh yes. I mean, I only knew about that through somebody else who told me that they'd seen my father in a film and that he'd won this medal. I mean, that's as much as he's, you know, boxed into his isolation. And so then I found out and I said, Dad, I'm sending you a film that you're in. And then we started to break down. He started to break into it and I tried to talk about it a bit and he talked about it a bit. But it's the most beautiful film, and he runs like a guard because he had to catch up a race that the runner before him was losing because he was ill, Frank Wolf. My father was in the second lap of the relay, and it's an extraordinary race. And the BBC recorded it too as one of the most outstanding athletical feats, and he won a record for that race. He held a record for many, many years for running, absolutely. And then after that, I think he stopped because he ran so well that I think he couldn't bear it and he had to stop. They're strange people, the men of those years.
Did you have a strict upbringing? Was he strict with you?
Yeah, but although I resented it, I'm quite glad I did have a strict upbringing. I like that.
You were also educated at private schools. Were you educated to be a very proper young British woman?
Yeah, in uniform and proper and learning, you know, with the manners of English girls at that time and all that. But I sort of, in my way, I rebelled in my heart against it, but I knew that it was building some strong fibre in me, and it had, because it's given me a very fine structure and a sense of discipline, which actually does only help in life yourself. You don't have to impose it on others, but you can, if you have it somewhere in the fibre of your soul, from your education, it's not a bad thing.
Were you told before you started acting that you were beautiful, and did that make your life any better, any easier? Were there any surprising complications from that?
No, because I don't think you really sort of do know that you're beautiful in a funny way. I know this sounds odd again, but if you ask any young, beautiful woman, they sort of... You just want to be part of the pack, actually, at that age. You just want to be... You just want to learn how to grow up and not be too... and not be taken out and sort of be shown that you're too different. I mean, that's how I felt.
But usually, you know, the assumption is being really attractive increases your stature, makes you more liked, more popular.
Yeah, it
more,
does.
More everything that young girls want to be.
Yes, but you, I mean, I knew that I didn't deserve it, and it wasn't anything to do with me. So I knew from a very early age that I should never play with this as some kind of weapon because it didn't belong to me. And it was useful. It could be useful. And it sure has been useful. And I've had fantastic years knowing that I'm beautiful. But I was also terrified about the whole, why did people like me more than my friend who was less beautiful? Why did I get the advantages? Why was always I asked out to parties and they weren't?
Were there things you really wanted to be noticed for that you felt you had more earned, that were more about your talents or your personality?
Well, you think so, but you don't quite know at that age. You think, you know, there must be other... You know there are other things, deeper hidden things that you want to learn about as you grow older and as you grow up. Deep things that you feel that are your value, your own personal unique value, that only belong to you as a unique individual, being part of a collective, but just almost on your own. And beauty is something that gives you pathways into all these fields if you want to. But I've always felt, I've really beaten myself up about it in a sense that I felt that I really had to earn it, that's all. And but then if I'd been ugly, it would have been the same thing. I'd have fought as hard to be accepted, and just because I'm not good looking, you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's the
right.
Battle is the same.
Right.
The battle actually is the same, but the supposedly the beautiful ones have the luckier, you know, have the luckier coin.
My guest is Charlotte Rampling. Her new film is called Under the Sand. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Charlotte Rampling. She's starring in the new film, Under the Sand. So you started making films when you were 17. Mm. You were 20 when your older sister died of a brain aneurysm, so you already had several films that you made. So just as you were, you know, becoming a star and entering into this exciting world, your sister died, and so you were in this kind of increasingly glamorous world at the same time you lost her. There must have been, well, just an incredible contrast between the world you were entering and the grief that you were feeling.
Yeah, and that's when I stopped making fun pictures. I was having a lot of fun. I was really having fun for 3 years, sort of my life. I really had fun. I mean, I'm not saying that I didn't, you know, haven't had later on, but much later on. And the guilt was just terrifying, you know, when somebody dies, and especially with my mother almost, you know, beside herself with grief. You just say, I can't make fun films anymore. So that's when I went into the darker side and did, you know, films. I sought out films that psychologically were much more painful.
Well, let me get to one that's probably about as dark as it gets. this is a film you're very famous for, the 1974 movie The Night Porter. Mm. And you play a concentration camp victim who, several years after the war, you meet up with a Nazi who abused you in the camp, and you both start up a very disturbing kind of sadomasochistic sexual relationship. The Nazi is played by Dirk Bogarde, who you also work with in 1969 in The Damned. How did you feel about taking this role? I mean, this is a role that some people would describe as very dark. Other people might describe it as disturbing. Others might call it kind of sick. You know, it's a pretty heavy role.
Yeah, it's about forbidden things, you know. Mm-hmm. and it's about areas that we don't often really want to go into and analyze and think about and turn over and look at. It's about, you know, it's about the deep, dark fantasy world that, you know, perhaps we dream about, but we don't really want to admit it. And I think the reason I took this film, I've lived on a very instinctual level, and my choices are sort of just, you know, grabbed somewhere inside. Because if you start to analyse why you would do Night Porter, and I just had a baby who was my first son, who was 3 months old. And when Dirk Bogarde called me, because I'd worked with him in The Damned of Visconti before, and when he called me, he said, look, I've decided to do this film after 5 years, because I turned it down 3 times. I've decided to do this film. There's only one girl that can do it, and I won't do it with anyone else but you. They wanted Romy Schneider at the time, who was a bit much bigger star. I wasn't a star at all at that time, so I didn't, you know, didn't wield any money or power or name. But when Liliana Cavani saw me with Dirk, she said that that was it, and there was a kind of fascinating thing that happened with Dirk and I around this subject. Dirk, for his reasons from the war and the pain and the horrors that he'd lived through the war, and me for what I'd been through on a personal basis. And so, you know, again, that was what we put into the film.
What did you think of as your character's motivation for entering into this relationship with an unreformed Nazi?
Well, she was abused and couldn't do anything else, like abused children. She was very young, she was 16. And when she saw him again, it was the only thing that she'd ever really, had really ever deeply affected her, whether it was love, whatever it was such an, it was so affecting to her, this experience that she had when she was 16 in the camp, that when she saw him again, she could not resist it and had to go plunging back into that darkness.
There's a very provocative scene in The Night Porter in which you're singing a very sultry cabaret kind of song in a room of Nazis. You're moving around the room slowly and evocatively, wearing baggy pants which are held up by suspenders, and the suspenders are the only garment that you're wearing from the waist up. Mm. Would you describe filming this scene?
Well, strangely, as films are, this film, that scene was the first scene I had to make in the film. And I arrived, and I not only had to learn the song, the German song of Marlene Dietrich, an old song of hers, but we also had to, you know, learn what we were going to do in this very sort of evocative, tragic scene. And it was the first thing we did. And you just do it. Leben, liebe ich zu leben. Ich kann nur sagen, ich liebe zu gefallen. Wenn auch nicht immer, liebe ich zu lieben. Ich weiß nicht, was ich will und dort erwarte viel.
That's Charlotte Rampling singing in a scene from the 1974 film The Night Porter. So what was the experience like of making a film that's this dark and this sexually dark? I mean, was it a disturbing experience for you to make the movie?
Yeah, completely disturbing. Mm. Completely disturbing. But you sort of put yourself on hold, you know. There's an odd technique that you have in this business is you put yourself sort of slightly in denial about a lot of stuff, because otherwise you can't really do it.
Right.
And you know that you can command your body into action to do it absolutely as you want to do it, but your mind is not quite connected to what you're doing. Your mind is somewhere else.
Had you sung much before this movie?
No, just like everybody, you know, singing away. And you do in voice classes, too, that I'd taken. There was singing, you know, singing lessons and how to project your voice. So I had worked on it. But the voice had to be very bad, really. It had to be not too good. It had to be the terrified, sort of strange voice of a 16-year-old singing under duress. And also, but also in a way, getting sort of a bit high on it. So there was all that mixed in.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I had read that you had considered singing when you were in your teens, but your father didn't want you to be a singer because it meant wearing short skirts at cabarets. I laughed so hard when I saw that because this is your singing debut here.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting you bring this up. I just hadn't thought about it. Absolutely true.
It's like his nightmare come true. He was worried about you wearing a short skirt, and here you are, like, you know, wearing nothing but suspenders and pants.
Right. A more decadent debut could you have not?
Precisely. Did he ever see the movie?
Well, he said he'd never seen it, but I found out that he had, but years and years and years later. And I wonder, actually, if he really had. Anyway. But we don't talk about my films at home. Well, my mum doesn't because she can't, but my dad never talks about my work.
It's
one of the subjects that we don't talk about.
Right, I got it.
But he's talking, as I say, he's coming out now a little bit, and he's really beginning. I mean, he was interested why I went to America and what is this film, you know, Under the Sand, first time we've ever actually talked about it. And this is since my mother died, interestingly. It's quite strange things unlock, don't they? You never know. And so he's now talking a little bit about them, and he's realizing a little bit what I've done in my life, and he's saying how proud he is of me and things like that. So it's really moving.
My guest is Charlotte Rampling. Her new movie is called Under the Sand. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Charlotte Rampling is my guest. She's starring in the film Under the Sand. You know how you were saying after your sister died, you really wanted to take roles that weren't like funny and entertaining, but roles that were in dark films because that was the mood that you were in. Did you at some point move away from that and feel that you could do entertaining or funny films again? They didn't have to just be about darkness.
Well, that came later. You see, that came, I would say, in my late 30s, really, when I decided not to make any films at all, because it just wasn't, I mean, I just, all this wanting to go into the darkness through films had been extraordinary, and I'd learnt a lot, but I'd come to a dead end, and I then sort of had to go into my own particular world. And then when I came out of that, I suppose that you can call that the depressive time, right? So when I come out of that, a few years later, then there was much more fluidity and choice, and and now films can I don't know where they'll lead me, but I'm much freer to be able to choose now. I have that choice.
Are you saying you went through a period of depression where you didn't even want to work?
Yeah, but that was very necessary too, obviously, on the kind of journey I was on. If you look at, in retrospect, I just had to go, had to go into that too, and just shut down. And then you learn other things which bring you out, and on you carry on.
How long was that shutting down period?
Well, it wasn't a complete shutdown all the time, but a complete shutdown for about 3 years, and then it sort of eased and eased and eased, and then you realize that you're coming into the light and you're able to actually begin doing things and connecting with the world and all that, and then it becomes, you realize that you're on, you're coming back into yourself, really, because you just completely lose yourself. It's really like dying, I suppose, in a way.
Was this in the 80s and the 90s?
This was in the 90s, yeah.
So one last question. When you were going through your depression, were you confident that you'd come out of it and that you'd eventually work again?
No.
Right. 'Cause it sounds like it went on for
for but a few you, years. But you know, you have two options, don't you? To somehow come through it or to take your life. You have two options, and that's why depression is a very serious thing, because you do have the option. A lot of people take the other option. I didn't. You know, there'd been enough death in my family, but I didn't know whether I'd come through, because it just, you know, you have no idea.
Right.
But I think most people do when I don't know the sort of the numbers of it, but you do somehow. I don't know how, and there's all sorts of different ways, but you do come through. But it takes an awful long time. There are various degrees, you know. There are various degrees. There are various intensities, too. Some people are much milder than others. Yeah, thank goodness.
You know, people always wonder, if you're talented, if you've made, you know, if you're a movie star and you're beautiful and you have money, how could you be so depressed, right? Like, why, when you have so many gifts?
Mm.
I think some people find that incomprehensible. But it seems it's just kind of beyond all that. It's something
yes,
more internal
you
than
see,
that.
Yeah, because you see, it's about your soul. It's about your spirit. And your spirit doesn't know about all that. And your soul doesn't know about advantages in this world, the wonderful advantages that I have been given, the beauty of, you know, and children and a career and all that. Your spirit and your soul doesn't know about that. And that's what we're talking about. Your spirit is yearning so, so deeply and is in such pain and you don't know why, and that's what you somehow... It's not having to find out, but you just have to nurture it and just to hope that, you know, you will come back wanting to live again.
Well, it's great to see you in movies again, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
That was very nice. Thank you. Thank you for talking to me.
Charlotte Rampling is starring in the new French film, Under the Sand. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shurok. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Monique Nazareth, with Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolon directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delta Trade Paperback, a division of Random House, publisher of Driving Mr. Albert, A Trip Across America with Einstein's Brain, a work of nonfiction by Michael Paternity. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the results of a new study using brain imaging to track neurological changes during meditation and prayer. We talk with Dr. Andrew Newberg, who conducted the study, and Dr. Michael Boehm, a longtime meditation teacher and stress reduction expert who participated in the study. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.